Okay, good afternoon, everybody. So this is Bio 241, and it's December 1st. So we have a couple more lectures left in the class. That's about it. Three more lectures. So this week, Monday, Wednesday, and then next week, Monday, and then after that, finals start. And so we don't have lectures during finals week in here. You don't have a lab during finals week either, so you'll know your lab grade by next week sometime. So, since we're on that topic, let's look at when your final is in here. I think I've mentioned it before, but I want to make sure everybody's on the right page because the syllabus is not correct. It got changed. The syllabus says December 10th, which is Wednesday, but your final is not until the Wednesday after that. So your final is Monday, December 15th at 2 p.m. No. At 1 p.m. At 1 p.m. in this room. Yeah, so Monday the 15th at 1 p.m. That's your final in here. Okay, so if someone has a concern regarding that date and time, make sure you let me know, and we'll deal with it at that time. Okay, so does anybody have any questions? No, good. I don't like questions. No, just kidding. All right, so we're going to move on to the next chapter, which I believe is 14, which is cardiac output, more involving the heart and how blood pressure is regulated. That's really what we're going to learn in this chapter. There are two main ways that blood pressure is regulated or heart activity is regulated. One way is due to just the inherent nature of the heart, how the heart is put together. We call that intrinsic control versus extrinsic control. Extrinsic control means that other things are necessary in order to control blood pressure. It might mean reflexes, might be neuronal reflexes, or it might be different hormones that help regulate blood pressure. Those are all extrinsic mechanisms. All right, so let's become familiar with cardiac output. And cardiac output is the flow out of the heart every time it beats. All right, so it's the volume of blood pumped per minute by each ventricle. And as a matter of fact, over a relatively short period of time, the amount of blood that the left ventricle pumps should equal the amount that the right ventricle pumps. Because if it doesn't, what's going to happen? Remember, the circulations are back to back. If one side of the heart isn't pumping the same as the other side, then blood is going to back up someplace in one of the circulations. Okay, so both sides of the heart have to pump about the same amount of blood. And the units of this are volume per minute. What's a good volume dimension to have? How would you measure a volume of something? Like milliliters is perfect. Yeah, you'd measure the milliliters, or you could say liters, but in this particular case, milliliters is even better. The total blood volume, in this case, is in an average person is 5.5 liters. All right, the stroke volume is a different kind of term. This is the amount of blood that's pumped per every time the heart beats. All right, that's the stroke volume. So the cardiac output, or the amount of blood that's pumped, is equal to stroke volume times your heart rate. And dimensionally, does that make sense to you if you were to look at the dimension? So if we got cardiac output, what's cardiac output should be? Volume pumped per minute. So cardiac output is, for instance, milliliters per minute. Right? What is that going to be equal to? That's going to equal stroke volume times heart rate. So what is stroke volume? That's a volume, well, instead of putting volume, I'm going to say what? Milliliters per beat, every time the heart beats, times the heart rate. What's that? Beats, number of beats per minute. But of course, when you look, the beat and beat cancels out, and what are you left with? Milliliters per minute, and is that what we have on the left side of the equation? Indeed, it should be, right? Okay, so that's how we calculate cardiac output. So, for instance, if we increase the heart rate, what's going to happen to somebody's cardiac output if everything else is held constant? Well, because cardiac output is directly related to heart rate. If we increase heart rate, that's going to increase cardiac output. All right? And if we increase stroke volume, what's going to happen to cardiac output? Well, since stroke volume is directly related to cardiac output, if we increase stroke volume, that's going to increase cardiac output. And if we increase both stroke volume and heart rate, then that really has a big effect on cardiac output, right? Because we multiply the increase together. Okay, so that's one equation that I'm probably going to keep up on the board. Cardiac output is equal to stroke volume times heart rate. Okay, so how do we regulate the heart? Well, without neuronal influences, the SA node, right, that's just the pacemaker of the heart, will drive the heart at its spontaneous activity, however fast it depolarizes. Normally, sympathetic and parasympathetic activity influence heart rate. We call that a chronotropic effect. So there are two ways that your nervous system can affect the heart rate. One is by adjusting the rate or the timing of how fast the heart contracts. And that's what we call a chronotropic event. All right, so that would be chronotropy, affecting the heart rate. Chrono just means time. If you have an agent that decreases the heart rate, is that a positive chronotropic agent or a negative chronotropic agent, would you guess? Something that decreases the heart rate. Is that a positive or a negative? That would be a negative. If you have something that increases the heart rate, that would be a positive chronotropic agent. All right, so chronotropy has to do with what? Heart rate only. If it's positive, it will speed it up. If it's negative, it will slow it down. All right, so that is chronotropy. So autonomic innervation of the SA node is the main controller of heart rate, or the chronotropy of the heart. Sympathetic and parasympathetic nerves modify the rate of those spontaneous depolarizations. Can you remember what kind of channels are responsible for those spontaneous depolarizations of the SA node? What kind of channels were those? Those were the HCN channels, okay, affecting the slope of depolarization, and indeed, here we can see it. Epinephrine and norepinephrine stimulate opening of the pacemaker HCN channels. This depolarizes the SA node faster, and since it depolarizes faster, then that's going to capture the whole heart, increasing the heart rate. Acetylcholine, on the other hand, doesn't open the HCN channels, but it promotes opening of potassium channels. So this is going to compete for the electrical activity of the HCN channels, and it's going to make the slope of the generator potential, okay, much more shallow. So for instance, we have three different conditions right here. The top condition is a normal heart rate. And remember, this is only of the SA node. These are not the contractile fibers of the heart, but this is a nodal fiber. There really is no such thing as resting membrane potential because those HCN channels are always going to be leaking sodium. And when they leak sodium, it depolarizes the cell. And when it reaches threshold, that produces this action potential. Okay, so here is an intermediate type slope, right? And that determines the time between these action potentials. But with sympathetic stimulation, at this point in time right here, we open up sodium channels, and that causes a faster depolarization, right? And that means that it takes less time to get to threshold, and so we have a faster heart rate due to sympathetic increase in sympathetic tone to the heart. And this third case down over here, if on the other hand we apply parasympathetic stimulation to the heart, that opens up potassium channels. And what does a potassium channel do? Does that depolarize or hyperpolarize? It's hyperpolarizing, right? So it's going to counteract the effects of these sodium channels, and that will decrease the slope of this generator potential or pacemaker potential, causing a longer duration between action potentials of slowing the heart down. Okay, so think in terms of this slope right here in terms of parasympathetic and sympathetic activity, but of course related to potassium and sodium. It's very easy to appreciate. Okay, the cardiac control center, part of the It's in the medulla oblongata. It coordinates activity of the autonomic innervation that goes to the heart. Sympathetic endings in the atria and ventricles can stimulate increased strength of contraction of the heart. So when you think of strength of contraction, we have to think of another word. Instead of chronotropy, we're not adjusting the heart rate, we're increasing force of contraction, or inotropy. So inotropy is force. And as you increase the force of contraction, what can you imagine what might happen to stroke volume? There's less blood left over in the heart when it starts to go into diastole because the heart contracts with more vigor. All right, so stroke volume increases as a result. All right, so here's a nice table that shows the effects of autonomic stimulation on the heart. And we'll see that it is not exactly symmetrical. All right, so don't forget, let's think of both in terms of inotropy and chronotropy. Yes, I know. When it is stimulated, it does receive innervation. It does receive dual innervation, namely the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous systems. So sympathetic nerves increase the rate of diastolic depolarization, increasing cardiac rate. Who's got a question about that one? Right? So the pacemaker potential becomes more steeper, and that cell reaches threshold sooner. That increases the rate of the heart rate. All right. Parasympathetic innervation on the SA node opens up those potassium channels that lowers the slope, so it takes longer to reach threshold. So that decreases the rate of diastolic depolarization, which decreases heart rate. And the same thing pretty much for the AV node. It increases the conduction rate through the AV node, so that signals get to the ventricles faster with sympathetic stimulation. And parasympathetic stimulation decreases the rate of conduction through the AV node. Now here there is a little bit of a difference because there are no parasympathetic fibers that go to the myocardium, the atrial myocardium or the ventricular myocardium. Parasympathetic fibers only go to the nodal fibers. So parasympathetic nerves have no significant effect on the contraction of atrial muscle or ventricular muscle. So parasympathetic stimulation, ooh, I need my laser, has no kind of effect. What kind of effect? It has no inotropic effect or chronotropic effect, would you guess? Because parasympathetic, it has no significant effect. And tell me something about what effect are we talking about? Are we talking about a chronotropic or inotropic effect? That would be the inotropic effect because it's going to muscle, right? It's devoid of fibers going to muscle, so it can't affect their force of contraction. But sympathetic fibers do. And it is stimulatory, so sympathetic innervation of the atrial muscle and ventricular muscle both cause an increased strength of contraction, force of contraction. And that's not chronotropy, that is inotropy. So sympathetic innervation is a positive inotropic influence on the heart, increases force of contraction. All right, so let's look at stroke volume. I think we've kind of looked at stroke volume already. It's determined by three variables. And the first one is end-diastolic volume. That's the volume of blood in the ventricles at the end of diastole. So is that the big volume or the little volume inside the heart? The little volume or the big volume? End-diastole. What happens during diastole? The heart fills, right? And as the heart fills, what happens to the volume of the heart? Gets bigger. So the end-diastolic volume is the big volume, right? That's the big volume of the heart. Total peripheral resistance, that's the impedance to blood flow in arteries, that's something else. And also contractility, that's the strength of ventricular contraction. Okay, so that's what stroke volume is related to. Okay, so the end-diastolic volume is the workload that's placed on the heart. Sometimes we call that the preload. Right, that's just the amount that the heart is stretched. And stroke volume is directly proportional to preload. So as the preload of the heart increases, what happens to contractility or stroke volume if it's directly related? If it's directly related, that means if one goes up, what happens to the other? They both go up, right? So stroke volume goes up when the preload or the stretch of the heart increases or the contractility increases. So the strength of contraction varies directly with the end-diastolic volume. And again, end diastolic volume is what? The big volume or little volume? The big volume, which means what? The heart is stretched out or not stretched out? It is stretched, right? So as the heart stretches, we're going to see contractility increases. So just stretching the heart is usually a positive inotropic influence. Okay, the total peripheral resistance, sometimes we call that the afterload, impedes ejection from the ventricle. And the ejection fraction, right, is the amount of blood that is pumped out every time it contracts compared to how much blood was in there at the very beginning. That's sort of like hematocrit, right? That's very much like hematocrit. Normally, the ejection fraction is 60%, and this is a very important measure for a heart that is sick. Maybe has a valve defect or a failing heart. It will maybe help timing of a particular surgery or valve restoration, and will also tell us what the prognosis is, what's going to happen to the patient afterwards. Okay, so you've run into this total peripheral resistance before because you've seen an equation like this, where flow, what is flow equal to of a fluid? What moves fluid around, whether it's a gas? Okay, we talked about this in the respiratory system, pressure. Okay, and is it just one pressure? You actually have to measure what a difference in pressure. Just like for diffusion, if there's no difference in concentration, molecules won't diffuse. But if there is a concentration difference, then molecules will move from high concentration to low. The same thing for pressure. Molecules will flow. Right? Not if the pressure is constant, there will be no flow, but if there's a difference in pressure, molecules will flow from high pressure to low. All right, so flow is going to be equal to what we call delta P. That's the difference in pressure between two points, all right, divided by what is going to resist that flow. And we call that resistance. And you can call that total peripheral resistance if you wish. Okay, so flow is equal to delta P over R. Right? And flow is what? What are the dimensions of flow? That's going to be, it's a volume per time. Milliliters per minute. What did we say cardiac output is? Milliliters per minute. So cardiac output and flow are really the same kind of terms. Okay, so let's just leave those two equations on the board. All right, so let's see why stretching of the heart increases contractility. Okay, stretching of the heart is the same thing as increasing the end diastolic volume or increasing the preload on the heart. And it has to do with the Frank-Starling law of the heart. It states that the strength of ventricular contraction varies directly with end diastolic volume, at least in the normal heart. So if it varies directly with it, what does that mean? As end diastolic volume increases, what happens to the strength of contraction if it's directly related? It increases as well. So as the heart stretches, it gets stronger. And that's actually a nice fortunate thing. This is part of the property of the heart, which we call the intrinsic property of the heart, because it just has to do with how the heart is built on the inside and has nothing to do with neuronal reflexes or the effects of hormones on the heart, like epinephrine or norepinephrine. So how do you understand that cardiac muscle contracts? What's the structural and functional unit inside heart muscle that allows it to shorten or to contract? Yeah, what's a structural and functional unit in skeletal muscle? That's a sarcomere. And remember, cardiac muscle tissue has sarcomeres, pretty much the same kind of arrangement as skeletal muscle. So when you say sarcomere, what kind of pictures do you have in your mind flashing before your very eyes? You have? What do you have? You see like A bands and I bands. What about proteins? What kind of proteins you got in there? Yeah, you got actin and myosin, and they overlap, right? They overlap like this. And what's a good model in your mind to explain how a sarcomere shortens with relationship to the actin and myosin? They slide over each other, right? They interdigitate and slide over each other. Okay, so keep that picture in your mind. All right, so as end-diastolic volume increases, the myocardium is stretched more, causing greater contraction and stroke volume because contractility increases. Well, let's take a look at this graph right here and see if that is indeed true. So here we have a plot of stroke volume versus ventricular end-diastolic volume. So as you're going out on this axis to the right, the heart becomes more and more stretched. It is stretching out. And as you come back this direction, that means what? The heart is not stretching out as much. That's the end-diastolic volume. And what happens to contractility of the heart? Well, let's just look at one curve first, maybe this bottom curve right here. So as the end-diastolic volume increases, what happens to stroke volume? Or what happens to the contractility of the heart? Is it increasing or decreasing? Can anybody see from this graph right here? As we move out, as the end-diastolic volume gets greater, what happens to contractility? If nothing happened, what kind of line would we have to draw? Flat, like this, just a straight line. All right? But as the heart stretched out, if the force decreased, then the line would have to go down. But you see that? What you see is when the end-diastolic volume increases, what happens to the force of contraction? It gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And that's what we call the Frank Starling law of the heart. Okay? As the heart expands, the force of contraction of the heart gets stronger. That's very important, and very important in terms of how we treat patients. The other thing that we see is that each one of these curves can be influenced by sympathetic nerve stimulation. All right, so here's with no sympathetic nerve stimulation, here's with a little bit, and then here's with a lot. Which one of these curves, let's say number one, number two, number three, shows a greater force of contraction? Number one, two, or three? At any particular end-diastolic volume. So at this one level right here, which curve shows the highest rate or the highest force of contraction? It's not this one. Not this one, it's the one that here that has the highest rate of sympathetic stimulation, right? Even at a given end-diastolic volume, sympathetic activity can cause the heart to contract with more vigor, with more contractility, with a greater force of contraction, as measured by stroke volume right here. Okay, so how on earth can we describe why it is when we stretch the heart, it gets stronger? It can pump more blood as the heart stretches. All right, well, don't forget your sarcomere, because here we have a sarcomere. Here are the Z discs right here, Z discs. All right, and let's look at four different possible conditions. Now, we're not looking at stroke volume or overall effects of the heart. We're just going to look at one muscle fiber, one muscle inside the heart. All right, and can you see that in case A over here is that muscle fiber stretched very much? You know what? Look at that distance between the Z discs. It's very short, right? It's not stretched at all. This corresponds to maybe the distance maybe at the end of systole, before the heart even fills whatsoever. The muscles are very short. And what can you tell me about this sarcomere right here? Can it contract any further? Can it contract? What's the state of contraction? What's possible for contraction with this sarcomere? Can the filament slide anymore? Not really, because the Z discs are already butting up against the myosin filament, so it really can't contract. It can't shorten any further, right? So at this point, that shows curve A right here, right? So if we stimulate this muscle and look at it, its contraction over time, it produces the lowest level of tension because these filaments can't slide past each other anymore. And then case number B, well, let's let the heart fill up a little bit. And as the heart fills up a little bit, what happens to the sarcomeres? They start to slide past each other because the end-diastolic volume is getting a little bit bigger. All right, so now this sarcomere can actually shorten, but to what degree? Just a tiny amount before the myosin bumps up again up against the Z-discs. All right, and then if we stretch the heart even a little bit further, okay, let's stretch the sarcomere to this particular case. Now we can see that there is still overlap between the myosin and the actin. But now the sarcomere can even contract farther. That's going to produce greater tension. And, right, if we stretch the heart even further, now we have a lot of room for this sarcomere to contract to produce tension. So as the heart fills up with blood, the sarcomere stretches, and we get a more appropriate overlap between the actin and myosin filaments that will produce a greater tension when this muscle fiber gets stimulated into contraction. All right, so that's what we call the Frank Starling Law of the Heart. So if we were to look, let's go back to this slide right here. Okay, that has some really important implications, for instance, on how we're going to treat somebody. So I'll actually draw a really nice Frank Starling curve right here. So here is stroke volume, and here is end diastolic volume on the heart. And what it really looks like is this. There's an ascending limb, there's a plateau, and a descending limb. Okay, so what does this say? When we're way out over here, what's happening to the strength of heart contraction or the inotropy of the heart when we're way out over here? It's actually decreasing as we stretch the heart out even further. Okay, so there's an optimal region, and then there are a couple of non-optimal regions. So for instance, let's talk about somebody that might be operating, who's living in this condition right over here, on the ascending limb of the Frank Starling curve. Now how might somebody get into this condition right here, where their end diastolic volume is so low? For instance, maybe you get into an accident and you have a hemorrhage, and what happens to your blood? Runs outside your body. Okay, if it's outside your body, it can't get back to your heart to fill the heart up. And if it can't get back to the heart to fill the heart up, what about the end diastolic volume? It gets small. Okay, so when the end diastolic volume is small, maybe due to hemorrhage, your contractility of the heart decreases. And when your heart function decreases, you can't maintain blood pressure, right? So that puts you in a very bad circumstance, say right in this region right here. And so your heart is failing just because you don't have sufficient blood volume to make the sarcomeres, the arrangement of the actin and myosin filaments, overlap properly so that your heart will contract with vigor. So what could we do for somebody that is on this ascending limb of the Frank Starling curve? What would we like to do for somebody who's experiencing heart failure, right? Their stroke volume is going down because blood is not going back to their heart. Okay. You might want to transfuse them with blood, but say if you don't have any blood, say you're a paramedic in an ambulance on the way to the hospital. You don't have blood. You can't transfuse your patient because you never did a cross match, blood typing and cross match. But what can you do to restore heart function for that individual? You can hook up an IV, right, and you can establish, you can give them fluids, right, you can give them saline, and as that saline enters their blood volume, that expands their blood volume, that increases end diastolic volume, what happens to their contractility of the heart when you give them an IV with fluids? What happens to the strength of their heart contraction? It increases because of this Frank Starling law of the heart. So just by giving fluids, we can bring somebody's heart vigor back, right? We can increase their contractility, which is going to help maintain their blood pressure. All right, now what about over here on the descending limb? What would you do for somebody over here? In this particular case, this looks a lot like heart failure. It's heart failure, because look what's happening to their stroke volume. It's what? It's decreasing, and you need a heart that is actually pumping blood. But as the heart fills up too much, what happens to the overlap between the actin and myosin? Stretches out way too far. Okay, if they can't form cross bridges, then they can't slide past each other. So what do we do to somebody in what we call fluid overload? Fluid overload. Their heart is stretching way too much. It loses contractility. What can we do for somebody with fluid overload? A diuretic. Turn their kidneys on to have them lose a lot of volume. It comes out of their blood, right? Less venous return to the heart. The heart doesn't stretch so much, right? And as the heart doesn't stretch so much, what happens to contractility? it goes back up. Okay, so this is a real important concern for people. All right, the Frank Starling Law of the Heart. Okay, so at any given end diastolic volume, contraction depends on the level of sympathoadrenal activity. That just means sympathetic activity. Epinephrine and norepinephrine produce increased heart rate and contraction. So heart rate would be a chronotropic effect, and contraction would be a inotropic effect, and it's going to be positive in both cases, and that's due to increased calcium in the sarcomere, which allows for cross-bridge cycling. Okay, so here we have a couple graphs of relative tension that's produced by muscle versus the length of the muscle for cardiac, and this is what, just the ascending limb of the Frank Starling curve. So as the muscle stretches, it increases force of contraction. But what we see over here with epinephrine, even at the same length of resting muscle, right, with sympathetic stimulation, the force of contraction is higher compared to without sympathetic stimulation. And then this curve right here just shows in comparison to skeletal muscle, which is neither here nor there, all right? But it, just compare these two curves. So this is with sympathetic, this is without sympathetic innervation. All right, so here's a pretty important flow diagram that shows cardiac output. The amount of blood that your heart is pumping out per minute is due to the heart rate times stroke volume. So what are some things that can affect the heart rate? Well, parasympathetic nerves affect heart rate. They can do what? It can decrease. It decreases heart rate because it's a negative chronotropic agent. Parasympathetic stimulation is a negative chronotropic agent, because it goes to the SA node and the AV node. Those are the only two places where it goes. All right, sympathetic nerves, on the other hand, go both to the SA node, AV node, but also to the cells, the myocardial cells themselves. All right, so sympathetic innervation, or increasing sympathetic tone, increases heart rate, the chronotropic effect, but it also increases strength of contraction. It's a positive inotropic effect, and that increases stroke volume. Okay. As the end diastolic volume increases, that increases stretch, that increases strength of contraction, as long as you don't get pushed over to that descending limb of the Frank Starling curve. But where most people live their lives when they have a healthy heart is not right here at the peak, okay, because right now we're kind of in a resting condition, but it's right in this region right here. All right, so that when we start exercising or presented with some kind of stressful situation, we still have room to increase the contractility of our heart. Okay, and maybe I'll show you how that happens in a little bit. Okay. All right, so venous return to the heart is very important. Because what does venous return to the heart, how does it affect anything in your heart? What's a parameter that it most directly affects? As blood is returning to the heart, what's it doing to the heart? It is stretching the heart out, right? And that increases the force of contraction, so that helps maintain blood pressure. All right, so this venous return controls the end diastolic volume, absolutely, the amount of stretch of the heart. And of course, that affects stroke volume. As the heart stretches, okay, stroke volume goes up. And as stroke volume goes up, what about cardiac output? How is stroke volume related to cardiac output? They're directly related, right? So if stroke volume goes up, so does cardiac output go up. So venous return is very important for maintaining cardiac output. It depends on blood volume and venous pressure. Blood volume can be adjusted by the amount of blood that you have, but if you've lost a lot of blood, what can we put in there? Temporarily a substitute like saline, okay, isotonic saline, to get your blood volume up to maintain contractility. Vasoconstriction of veins, as well as arteries, will help maintain cardiac output. Venous return can also be controlled by skeletal muscles. And I think maybe we showed you this. So same thing for veins, right? The veins are going through a muscle, and when a muscle contracts, it bulges, and it's going to press on that blood. And it presses on the blood, it pressurizes it, so it squirts back to the heart. So just activity of skeletal muscles will help venous return. And even pressure during inhalation. When you expand your thoracic cavity, the pressure in your chest decreases. That will draw blood up from the periphery into the thoracic cavity. Okay, so venous return is influenced by blood volume. And one of the things that regulates blood volume is urine volume. So if you're losing a lot of fluids through urine, then that's got to come out of blood volume. All right, so if blood volume is being maintained, that maintains venous return, which maintains end-diastolic volume, which maintains your heart contractility and blood pressure. Okay, breathing increases venous return, and also venous pressure due to venoconstriction due to sympathetic nerve innervation, and don't forget about the skeletal muscle pump. As you use skeletal muscles, that increases venous pressures, which squirts blood back to the heart, increasing end-diastolic volume, which maintains cardiac output. Okay, I'm not going to talk about that slide at all. All right, so the next topic, blood and body fluid volumes. Okay, so we saw on this slide right here, tissue fluid volumes, okay, are going to be, and urine volume is mostly going to be controlled by the kidney. Okay, so after our brief discussion so far, do you think the kidneys have anything to do with maintaining blood pressure or cardiac function? Yeah, because of the link between just the volumes, blood volumes in the cardiovascular system, and what controls that. Are the kidneys. Okay, so ADH, we say right here is vasopressin, but what really is ADH? What does that stand for? Antidiuretic hormone. So does that make you pee or not pee? Not pee, right? So when you don't pee, where does that fluid stay? Inside your body, right? So that stays inside your body. All right, so ADH is released by the posterior pituitary when osmoreceptors, these are receptors that can measure osmolality of the blood, detect high osmolality. Now, what does that mean? Does that mean that internally you're becoming more salty or less salty? More salty or more dilute if your osmolality increases? Yeah, more salty, right? You're becoming more salty, less water, right? So the posterior pituitary releases antidiuretic hormone, all right? So these receptors are stimulated from excess salt intake or dehydration. One of those two are going to cause that. So that's going to give you the sensation of thirst, so you'll drink water to decrease the osmolality of your blood, but it's also going to stimulate water resorption from the urine that's being produced by the kidney. And then ADH release is inhibited by low osmolality. That's when your blood becomes dilute, when you have a lot of water in the blood. Okay, so let's look at this diagram right here. Let's start with the stimulus of dehydration or what? Salt ingestion, right? We said that. Intake, excess salt intake or dehydration. All right, dehydration is going to decrease blood volume, but it's also going to make the blood very salty. That increases blood osmolality. And of course, there are osmoreceptors in the hypothalamus that can notice that change. Right, and the hypothalamus is going to signal the posterior pituitary to increase the secretion of antidiuretic hormone to retain water in your body. The hypothalamus is also going to give you the sensation of thirst, right? All right, and so when you're thirsty, you're going to drink. That increases blood volume, and that's going to decrease blood osmolality. This increase in ADH is going to cause water retention by the kidneys. So you're going to be absorbing water that otherwise you would lose. That's going to increase blood volume and decrease blood osmolality. So this is the response, and what was, so increased blood volume is response, what was the initial stimulus? Decrease, yeah, dehydration or decreased blood volume. So when the response subtracts from the stimulus, what kind of feedback loop is that? That's a nice negative feedback loop, and does that maintain homeostasis usually or drive you further away from homeostasis? Yeah, it maintains homeostasis, and is that a good thing or a bad thing? Well, if you want to stay alive, that's a really good thing, right? Okay. Okay, so antidiuretic hormone from the posterior pituitary, okay, helps regulate your blood volume, and we're going to see that it's going to help regulate your blood pressure and contractility of the heart. All right, so we were looking at the Frank-Starling law of the heart, which is an intrinsic mechanism for regulating the heart, and antidiuretic hormone, right? Do you think this is an intrinsic mechanism or extrinsic mechanism? Is it something that just relies on the heart, or does it rely on other things that are outside of the heart? It relies on other things outside the heart, like the pituitary gland and the cardiovascular system and the kidneys, right? So this is what we call an extrinsic mechanism for helping regulate the heart. The only intrinsic mechanism is the Frank-Starling law. Okay, here is another extrinsic mechanism, all right, and it has to do with another hormone called aldosterone. And it is a steroid hormone secreted by the adrenal cortex. It helps maintain blood volume and pressure through reabsorption and retention of salt and water at the, where do you retain salt and water? What organ retains salt and water? The kidney, right? So we're talking about the kidneys again. So again, the kidneys are very important. There's an important interrelationship between the cardiovascular system and the kidneys through water and salt balance. Aldosterone release is stimulated by salt deprivation, low blood volume, and low blood pressure. Okay? And here is the system that helps regulate blood pressure. It's called the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism or system. Right, and sometimes I actually like to say the dreaded renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism. But after you look at it a couple times and diagram it out, it shouldn't be so dreaded for you. Okay. When there is salt deficit or low blood volume, right, and if there's low blood volume, you're going to have, in terms of blood pressure, what's going to happen to blood pressure when your blood volume is decreased? Okay, it decreases as well. An easy way to think about this, and it's not too wrong to think of it in this particular way. Say if you walk out to your car after class and you see your tires are flat, what does that mean? That the pressure is too high or too low in those tires? It's too low, right? And how are you going to fix that? You're going to drive to a gas station and you get to a pump at the gas station. And are you going to take air out of the tire or put air in the tire? Yeah, you put air in the tire that boosts the pressure inside that tire. The same thing for your cardiovascular system. If your blood pressure is too high, what is one way to lower it in terms of blood volume? Put more volume into the blood or take volume out? Take volume out. But if your blood pressure is too low, what could you do? Put volume back in, just like your car tire. Okay, so that's a nice model for you to think of. Okay, when there's a salt deficit, low blood volume, or low blood pressure, right? When you have low blood volume, you're going to have low blood pressure. Angiotensin II is produced. Okay, now we're going to see how that happens. Angiotensin II causes a number of effects, all aimed at increasing blood pressure. Okay, so how does this happen? Well, we see angiotensin II on your diagram right there. Well, before that, there is something called angiotensin, guess what? 1. Okay, angiotensin 1. And angiotensin 1 comes from a precursor molecule. Angiotensin, how do we write the name of something that's not active but can be converted into something active very quickly? You could say pro, but in this particular case we don't. We use the suffix, which is ogen. All right, angiotensin O-gen is the inactive protein that is floating around in your blood all the time, ready to go to work. Okay, so angiotensinogen is converted into angiotensin 1. Angiotensin 1 is converted into angiotensin 2. Okay, and that's sort of what we're talking about at the moment, angiotensin 2. Okay, the thing that converts angiotensinogen into angiotensin 1 comes from the kidney, and it's an enzyme. And it's not released all the time. It's only released when your blood pressure starts to decrease, and that is an enzyme called renin. That's from the kidney. And in particular, a part of the kidney that we don't spend a whole lot of time with in anatomy, but maybe we should because it's important, it's called the juxtaglomerular apparatus. Maybe you've bumped into it kind of in passing, or if you had a really good anatomy teacher, they would tell you a lot about it. All right, but the kidney measures low blood pressure or too much fluids, releases renin. Renin converts angiotensin into angiotensin 1. And then angiotensin 1 is converted into angiotensin 2, which is the active form of angiotensin. And that is done primarily in the lung. So it converts angiotensin 2, and an angiotensin 2, let's talk about the effects of angiotensin 2. Okay, it causes vasoconstriction. All right, so what happens to blood pressure when there is vasoconstriction? Think of a balloon that you have filled with air, and you squeeze down on that balloon. What happens to the pressure? Does it go down? Does it stay the same, or does it go up? It goes up. And if you squeeze really hard, it's going to what? It's going to pop because the pressure is way too high, right? So that is going to increase blood pressure, and can we see that that response subtracts from the initial stimulus? So this is another nice negative feedback mechanism, right? Okay. Angiotensin 2 is also going to cause aldosterone secretion, and it's also going to trigger the hypothalamus to tell you that you're thirsty. So you're going to drink, right? And when you drink something, what happens to low blood volume? That's going to counteract low blood volume, right? So this is another nice negative feedback mechanism that brings your blood pressure back up. So the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism, when it's activated, does what? It increases your blood pressure. It increases your blood pressure. And from what we understand, I tell you what, let me ask you another question. Don't forget about anything we've said so far, but let me ask you a question. And that is there a prevalent disease process that involves regulation of blood pressure, and what's it called? Hypertension. And is it prevalent? Is it a problem? Oh, absolutely, it's a problem. Okay, a lot of people have hypertension. And we believe people have hypertension because the dreaded renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism is not working properly in people. All right, so if we want to help adjust somebody's blood pressure with hypertension, we think, well, we should manipulate this system right here. All right, so the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism is the most important mechanism for regulating your blood pressure, not on a second-to-second basis, but over long-term, from day-to-day or week-to-week or even month-to-month. And when it's not behaving properly, it produces hypertension, which is a very deadly disease to have. It won't kill you overnight, but over a period of years, it certainly will. Okay, so let's talk about aldosterone a little bit by putting it all together on this particular slide right here. So the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system, we see the stimulus is decreased blood pressure or decreased blood flow to the kidneys, which is the same thing as decreased blood pressure. The juxtaglomerular apparatus is going to release renin when blood pressure decreases. Right, that's going to convert angiotensinogen, which is always available in your body to go to work. Right, so renin is just an enzyme that produces angiotensin 1. That is not active. It's partially active, but not very effective. The most effective form is what we call angiotensin 2. And there is an enzyme in the liver that's called ACE. What does that stand for? Angiotensin converting enzyme. So angiotensin converting enzyme converts angiotensin 1 into angiotensin 2. Angiotensin 2 causes vasoconstriction of arterioles, which then increases blood pressure. All right, but angiotensin 2 also goes to the adrenal cortex and tells the adrenal cortex to release aldosterone. Aldosterone is a hormone that goes to the kidneys and it causes salt retention. And as salt is reabsorbed from the kidney and put into your blood, there's something else that goes along with it, just for the ride. Water, that's right. As we increase the osmolality of your blood, more water is going to be reabsorbed from the kidney or from urine and put into your blood. Therefore, that increases blood volume, but it's also going to increase what, the sodium content of your body. All right, so these are the effects of the renin angiotensin aldosterone mechanism. Increases blood volume, increases blood pressure by these couple different mechanisms. So this is the response. How does that relate to the initial stimulus? Is it the same or opposite? Does it add to or subtract from? The initial stimulus was decreased blood pressure, decreased blood volume. Oh, I don't have that here. We should have that there. All right, which is opposite compared to the response. So the response subtracts from the stimulus. So this indeed is a nice negative feedback mechanism, which goes away when blood volume and blood pressure, all right, are at the set point. And so this is going to maintain normal blood volume and blood pressure if the person is operating normally. But in some people, the system doesn't operate properly. Okay, and we don't always know why. Maybe because sometimes they have way too much salt in their diet, way too much sodium. And the American diet contains probably 50 or 60 times the minimum daily requirement for sodium. Right, unless you cook your own food. But anytime you go eat almost anywhere, it's just way too much sodium. Okay. So how could we treat somebody with hypertension, which is what? High blood pressure. There, we could give diuretics. What's a diuretic going to do? It's going to decrease blood volume. All right, so that's a nice first line way of treating something. Also, there are ACE inhibitors. Guess what ACE inhibitors do? They prevent the conversion of angiotensin 1 into angiotensin 2. All right, and that causes that inhibits the release of aldosterone. Right, and then by inhibiting aldosterone, okay, you're going to lose salt and water in the kidneys. That's going to decrease blood volume, the same effects as a diuretic. Right, and a person's blood pressure will come down as a result of that. Okay, so that's two ways. There are also aldosterone receptors. These are kind of new kinds of drugs. I don't know how well they're working out. There's aldosterone receptor blockers, which block the effect of aldosterone, which decrease blood volume, which then decreases blood pressure. And then we also said, which is not on this chart right here, okay, there are drugs that can affect vasoconstriction or vasodilation in your body. So when you vasoconstrict, what happens to your blood pressure? It increases, so we can give drugs to cause a vasodilation in blood vessels that decreases blood pressure, okay? And because there are many things that affect blood pressure, treating hypertension sometimes is a little bit complicated, because if you take one drug to lower your blood pressure, guess what your body does? It takes another route to boost it back up. Okay, so usually when somebody has hypertension, they have to take maybe two or three different kinds of drugs that work in two or three different places in their body, okay, to maintain blood pressure at a proper level. And sometimes that could take a year, or maybe even 2 years, depending on how serious somebody is, to maintain their blood pressure. And if you have any family members, you got to be considerate and you got to really support them, because it might take a long time. But if they have hypertension, what's going to happen to them? They're going to die. They're going to have a stroke. They're going to have heart attacks, all kinds of cardiovascular events. So you got to really be assertive but yet gentle, because if you have a family member with hypertension and they're not taking their medication, can you run up to them and shake them and say, take your blood pressure medication. What's that going to do? That's going to produce a high blood pressure just doing that, right? So you got to be really careful with them. But just try to support them as much as you can to get their blood pressure under control, because it is a deadly disease. And it might take a while with work with their physician to figure out what regime of pharmaceutical agents is good for them. Oh, and the other bad thing. Here's another bad thing about treating hypertension. Usually when you have a disease, how do you feel? Do you feel good or bad? Like when you have the flu, you feel bad. Now with hypertension, guess what? It's not like that at all. As I guess we call this the silent killer, because when somebody has hypertension, which is the disease state, that's when you feel great. And when your blood is normal, like when you start taking treatment for hypertension, that's when you feel bad. And so that's why people with hypertension need a lot of support, because when it's properly controlled, that's when they feel bad. And when hypertension is there killing them, that's when they feel good. So it's kind of the opposite that you might expect. Okay. The third hormone, atrial natriuretic peptide, or hormone, comes from the heart. And what part of the heart? The atrium. That's right. It's in the name of this particular hormone. It's a peptide. Natriuretic. Natria stands for natrium. What's natrium? What is natrium? It is? Natrium is, it's Greek, I believe, for sodium, right? Because what's the chemical abbreviation for sodium? It is Na, right? So natriuretic is a hormone that puts sodium in the urine. What did aldosterone do? Salt retention, take salt out of the urine. So now we see a kind of a nice relationship between aldosterone and atrial natriuretic hormone. They are what? They are antagonistic to each other. So that's really a beautiful thing, right? All right, so atrial natriuretic hormone also inhibits aldosterone, promoting salt and water excretion to lower blood volume. It also promotes vasodilation. So what happens to your blood pressure? It decreases, right? And the reason why it is released is because when you have venous return to the atrium, it stretches. And as the atrium stretches, it's going to release atrial natriuretic hormone to decrease blood volume as a result. Okay, so we talked about three different hormones so far. Oh, maybe we'll look at this slide. But I'll put these three hormones on the board. The three hormones. So you got to kind of get a little feel for what these hormones are doing. What's the first one we talked about? ADH. Aldosterone. And what's the other one? Atrial natriuretic hormone. Or your book calls it something else, peptide. Same kind of thing. Okay? It's the same thing. So let's just look at what atrial natriuretic peptide, what it does in the body. Okay, so increased blood volume increases venous return to the heart, right? Anytime you increase blood volume, that increases venous return to the heart. And as the heart fills up with blood more, what's going to happen to the stretch of the heart? It increases. It stretches more, right? So increased venous return causes stretch of the left atrium. The left atrium is going to then release atrial natriuretic hormone. And that's going to go to the kidneys. So this is a hormone that travels in the blood to the kidney. And it causes the excretion of sodium and water from the kidney. So that increases urine volume, right? As you lose these substances, that increases urine volume. And as your body is losing fluid volume, what happens to your blood volume? Can you see that it decreases? As you pee volume out of your body, that decreases your blood volume. Now, what's the effect of decreased blood volume on venous return? Okay, as you have less blood can flow back to the heart. That means that the heart won't stretch out quite as much. All right, but the other thing this means, though, is that your blood pressure is going to decrease as well. Okay, because when you decrease venous return, on the ventricles, what happens to force of contraction of the ventricles as the end diastolic volume decreases? That's that Frank Starling curve. Okay. As the heart doesn't stretch, what happens to contractility of the heart? It decreases. As the heart stretches, the heart actually gets stronger. All right, so that's another mechanism that is working here as well. Okay, so the contractility of the heart decreases, so the blood pressure is going to decrease as well. So what's the effect of blood pressure with these three different hormones? So I'm going to put BP right here, blood pressure, ADH, antidiuretic hormone. Where is water going to go? Stay in your body or are you going to lose it? Stays in. So what happens to blood pressure? Increases blood pressure. What about aldosterone? What's happening there? Retaining salt, namely sodium, retaining water. What happens to blood pressure? It goes up. Oh, that kind of looks like a losing proposition. Which way is your blood pressure going so far? Only up. Okay? And then you got a final in a week or two. Okay? And then atrial natriuretic hormone. What happens there? Atrial natriuretic hormone causes water loss and sodium loss, so your blood pressure is going to go down. Right, so ADH and aldosterone, how would you describe the relationship between ADH and aldosterone? Synergistic, they work together. Okay, what about two hormones that are antagonistic to each other? What are two that are antagonistic to each other? ADH and? Atrial natriuretic hormone, they're antagonistic with respect to each other, right? So there is antagonism in this control system, but I think it's this one right here that is the prime one, and when it misbehaves, that produces hypertension that can't be overcome completely with atrial natriuretic hormone. Okay, so factors affecting blood flow. So we looked at, so these are all extrinsic mechanisms, right? These three hormones are extrinsic mechanisms. What's the intrinsic mechanism for regulating the heart called? Yeah, the Frank Starling law. Frank Starling law of the heart. That's intrinsic. Okay, so vascular resistance, what's the effect of vascular resistance and blood flow? All right, so vascular resistance determines how much blood flows through a tissue or an organ. And you're kind of familiar with this because you did a pretty nice lab with this topic a number of weeks ago. All right, so vasodilation decreases resistance, and that increases blood flow. Vasoconstriction does the opposite. So where do we have that? We have that with this equation right here. The flow through a tube is equal to, if there's no pressure difference on either end of the tube, nothing's going to flow through it, divided by the resistance, right? So if we increase the resistance and keep the pressure the same, since resistance is inversely related to flow, when resistance goes up, what happens to flow? It goes down, okay? So we're interested in this resistance term right here. And that could be, we could even consider that total peripheral resistance, okay? This is just a slide that shows the distribution of blood flow or cardiac output to various organs in your body, and I think you can see that the brain requires a lot of flow and the heart requires a lot of flow and skeletal muscles when you use them, but one that really kind of stands out because it's a very small organ are the kidneys. Okay, that's almost 25% of cardiac output goes through the kidneys, okay, because they're highly metabolic and they're doing a big job for us all the time, like regulating blood pressure, for instance. Okay, so blood flow through the vascular system means that blood will only flow when there is a difference in pressure between the two ends. So here we have the cardiovascular system. This looks like the systemic circuit right here, right? So at the left ventricle, we have a pressure of 120 over 80, and at the right atrium we have a zero pressure, so that means that the delta P, or pressure difference, is 100 minus zero, or 100 millimeters of mercury, on average, because the mean pressure is 120 over 80, which is 100 millimeters of mercury. So that's the driving force for blood through the systemic circulation. All right, so here is P1, here is P2 in this equation, the delta pressure equation. All right, so the flow rate is inversely proportional to resistance, like what I have on the board. Flow is equal to the pressure difference divided by resistance. And resistance we can take a look at because of Poiseuille's equation. Okay, it's going to be proportional to the length of the vessel. So we're looking at this denominator in this flow. So R is going to be equal to what? The length of the vessel. As the vessel length gets bigger, so does the resistance. It's just directly related. What else do we have? Viscosity. All right, as the viscosity of the substance increases, like if your heart had to pump molasses through your blood instead of through your cardiovascular system, that would be what? That would slow the flow down, right? So as viscosity increases, flow decreases. And that also then helps influence what somebody's hematocrit can be. Because we like to think, well, if we just put red blood cells in your blood, it'll have better oxygen carrying capacity. But what happens to the viscosity of your blood when we just pack it full of red blood cells? Well, it turns into glue. It doesn't flow, right? So viscosity is an important term. What else do we have? Okay, that's pretty important. Now the term, right, that plays the biggest role in resistance of a blood vessel is its diameter. So here is a diameter, right? Actually, let's not talk about diameter. Diameter is the distance from one wall to the other. But what we're interested in is from the center to one side over here. This is what we call the radius. Okay, mathematically, this is the radius from the center to the vascular wall. And this is the experiment that you did in lab. As we vasodilate, as we make R bigger, what happens to flow? It goes up in a big way, okay? Because resistance is not just equal to the radius right here, but it's equal to the radius, what? Times the radius, times the radius. Am I getting really weird and carried away right here? Times what? The radius. All right, so this is true. Right, and so what do we call radius times radius times radius times radius? That's radius to the fourth power. Right. All right, so this is the term that influences things the most. Small changes in the radius, because it's the fourth power rule, changes the resistance dramatically, and because resistance helps determine flow, it determines flow to a particular part in your body. All right, so that is just Poiseuille's equation. So we take resistance right here and put it into this equation, and what do we get? We get that thing over there, because viscosity and length are in the denominator right here, but radius to the fourth power is way down over here, so we can bring it up to the numerator. And so we have Poiseuille's equation. Okay, so blood vessel diameter, or a way of thinking about it in terms of physiology, is what? The vasodilation or vasoconstriction determines flow through a tissue because of the fourth power rule of the radius. And this pi over 8 is just in there to make pressure units match up with length units and that kind of thing. It's just a proportionality constant. So if we look at blood pressure, all right, so here we have blood pressure versus various blood vessels in our body. Okay, we can see that in the left ventricle, it goes from 0 when it's filling up to 120 at the end of systole. That's the peak systolic pressure. So you can see every time the heart beats, okay, it goes from 120 to 0. Blood is ejected into large arteries. Like, give me the name of a large artery. Like the aorta, for instance. Okay, so then it's going to vary from 120 at the end of systole to 80 if that's normal blood pressure at the end of diastole, because all of the blood that's pumped out of the heart into the aorta doesn't leave the aorta during diastole. Plus, the aorta has elastic tissues. The aorta expands, and during diastole, the aorta contracts because of the elastic properties that helps maintain blood pressure. So large arteries, we see that there is a big pulse in blood pressure. Then, guess what happens in small arteries and arterioles? You can see a dramatic drop in blood pressure, and most blood pressure drop is found in arterioles, because arterioles can vasoconstrict and vasodilate the most compared to any other kind of blood vessel in our body. All right, and we'll see why that's important. So why do you, I'll just ask you, why do you think arterioles are designed to vasodilate or constrict? What are arterioles doing for us? Okay, well, we see that there's a big drop in blood pressure right there in arterioles. That's probably not such a good thing. But as arterioles vasoconstrict, it's turning off blood supply to one organ, right? And if there's vasodilation in some other part of your body, then blood is going to go to that area. So we don't have enough blood in our body to go everywhere if we used all of our body at one time. So, for instance, after a meal, guess where blood is going to? Your digestive tract. And you shouldn't exercise during that time because you don't have enough blood to go everywhere. All right, so if you're going to exercise, for instance, you're a professional athlete, you want to do it right after a meal? No, you should do it more in a fasted state when you don't need blood going to your digestive tract to digest things and absorb nutrients. You need blood going to muscles for exercise. All right, so these arterioles will vasoconstrict or dilate depending on what part of your body needs blood at that particular time. So that's why there's this big drop in blood pressure in arterioles. All right, so what's the blood pressure right here? Let's say at the beginning of a capillary, what does it look like? What's the blood pressure? You have to read the graph. What does that look like? Okay. Well, if I slide over without changing, okay, it looks closer to 20, okay, maybe 30, just qualitatively, so between 20 and 30, but closer to 20. All right, and then at the end of a capillary, you can see it's, you know, a little less than 10, something like that. So 10 to 20 millimeters of mercury is how we would read this graph. So would you say that the blood pressure in capillaries is the lowest? Or I could ask you, what blood vessel does have the lowest blood pressure? Okay, and a lot of students say without thinking, oh, capillaries have the lowest blood pressure. Okay, but on this graph right here, you see that that is not true. All right, and please get that straight. Capillaries don't have the lowest blood pressure, but what is significant about capillaries? What's happening there? Is anything special happening there? Yeah, that's a site for exchange. And you don't need zero pressure to have exchange. As a matter of fact, how does a fluid flow? High pressure to low pressure, and if the capillary had the lowest pressure, how would blood flow with respect to a capillary? It would flow from an artery, which is high pressure, into a capillary, but it would also flow from a vein into a capillary, right? Because zero is the lowest pressure, and so blood can't flow just into a capillary, because, well, what would happen then? If venous blood flowed into capillaries and arterial blood flowed into capillaries, what would you'd explode, right? I'm just being silly. That wouldn't happen, but blood wouldn't circulate through your circulatory system, right? All right, so veins have the lowest blood pressure, and that's going to draw blood back to the heart. Okay, so blood can be shunted from one organ to another depending on its use by these arterioles right here, whether they vasoconstrict or vasodilate. Okay, so here is just a little illustration that kind of shows that. Arterioles play a role in blood distribution and can also control a blood pressure. Right? Blood flow to capillaries and blood pressure is controlled by the aperture or the radius of arterioles. All right, so here we have a model of your circulatory system. And here we have some capillary beds, and then here we have some pressure that's being developed by the heart, the pumping action of the heart. And we can see that as the height of this column of fluid. And as we increase the height of this fluid in this column, that does what to pressure? That increases pressure, right? If we made this a really tall column, then there'd be a lot of blood squirting out over here. But if it's just a very little height, then blood is just going to kind of dribble out, right? Okay, so here we have some arterioles here and here and here feeding these various capillary beds for these tubes. So if we put a constriction right here that's going to impede flow into this organ, look at what happens to the pressure. As we vasoconstrict, that's going to decrease pressure in this capillary bed. And what else does that mean? If we impede flow through this part of the body, we're going to have less coming out here, which means what? It's going to maintain pressure on this side. So this is going to shunt blood from this part of the circulatory system into this part over here. For instance, organs that are being used at some particular time, like maybe your digestive tract after a meal. All right, so these are the organs that are going to receive blood because of this vasoconstriction. And after a meal, this vasoconstriction would happen, for instance, at a muscle. Okay, so this is how blood is shunted from one way to the other. So here we have a diagram that shows a number of different things versus the size or the different labels of blood vessels that we have. We have the aorta, arteries, small arteries, arterioles, capillaries, then anastomosing to form venules, veins, and then even a large vena cava. So if we look at the surface area or the cross-sectional area of a blood vessel, that's going to be determined by the radius of that blood vessel, we see that the cross-section of the aorta is pretty small because it's just one blood vessel. All right, and then the aorta is going to bifurcate into numerous blood vessels. But if we add up the cross-sectional area of all the blood vessels that the aorta bifurcates into, we can see what? That the area increases. And as these blood vessels bifurcate more and more and more and eventually get into capillaries that bifurcate thousands of times, look what happens to the cross-sectional area if we were to add up the radius or the diameter of all these blood vessels, which we have millions and millions of capillaries. We see that the cross-sectional area increases dramatically as a result. Okay, and as the cross-sectional area increases, the velocity of blood decreases. So the velocity of blood is going to look inverse compared to this curve that we see for surface area. So the question I have is, in what part of the cardiovascular system is the velocity of blood the slowest? Not the flow, but just the velocity. Where does blood flow the slowest from one point to another? It's inversely related to the cross-sectional area. So what part of the cardiovascular system has the largest area, cross-sectional area? It is the capillary right here. And that's a place that has the slowest flow, but that's kind of significant because what's happening in capillaries? What's it designed to do? Exchange, right? So if blood didn't spend time in the capillaries, that would decrease exchange. But because it has the highest surface area, this is the slowest flow, and this allows for the most exchange. So blood flows very rapidly in the aorta and veins, but the slowest in capillaries. But it slows slowly, not because it's the lowest pressure, but because it is the highest area. Okay, so capillaries have pressure. It's the veins that don't have pressure. That's what that slide shows. Okay, so blood pressure. What is it controlled by? And you know what? I guess we're going to start here next time. It's controlled mainly by heart rate, stroke volume, and peripheral resistance. Because what is heart rate and stroke volume equal to? It's equal to cardiac output. All right, and so we're interested in what? Blood pressure. And we're interested in then flow and resistance. So we could rearrange this by doing what? Delta P is equal to flow times resistance. So this is kind of fascinating. It's not very intuitive. What happens to pressure if resistance increases? Is it inversely related or directly related? It's directly related. So the mathematics shows you something that's hard to have an intuitive sense for, but if resistance increases, pressure increases. Right? This is pretty intuitive. If flow increases, if cardiac output increases, so does blood pressure. But the hardest thing to see is when resistance increases, so does pressure. So that when you vasoconstrict, that does what? That increases resistance, that increases blood pressure, just because of this relationship right here. So I'm going to start here next time. So blood pressure increases when flow increases or resistance increases. Who's going to remind me to start here next time? Okay, good.